Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Welcome to Risky Business for this Tuesday, the 5th of February, 2008. This week's podcast is brought to you by Sophos Security and Control. Now, we've actually got a fair bit of news to catch up on this week. There's the much-feared terrorists getting access to high-grade crypto through the supposed media arm of Al-Qaeda, the Global Islamic Media Front. But I've got my own spin on that one, so stay tuned. Bruce Schneier was in Melbourne last week and used his visit to take a crack at the vendors, and there's a couple of other stories worth a mention as well. ZDNet Australia's editor Mania Katadia will be along shortly to have a chat about those. Today's feature topic is one that many listeners won't know much about: the controls on the infrastructure that powers our economy. We're talking about the gear that large financial institutions use to conduct their day-to-day trading activity. Increasingly, those wishing to conduct fraud in this arena have to be tech-savvy, as well as understanding how to set up shady, fake companies and trades that go under the radar and unnoticed. Chief Security Officer Adam Poynton will be along soon to enlighten us. In this week's sponsor interview, Paul Ducklin from Sophos Security and Control will be along to have a somewhat controversial yarn to Risky Business. Or counterintuitive, if not controversial. Many people see today's complicated malware as a hydra with many heads. You cut one off, another one grows. Duck disagrees and says you can slay the malware beast a lot easier than you'd think. That's coming up later. But first, as always, we're joined by Mania Katadia to discuss this week's news. Mania, you know, I've got to give it to you guys for this headline: jihadists get world-class encryption kit. But I've got a couple of bones to pick.
I bet you do. Go on.
Well, what is it? I mean, why don't we just talk about what the story says to begin with?
Yeah, the story says that the Global Islamic Media Front has released a new set of encryption tools, basically to help the militants conduct clandestine communications. And so, that's according to VeriSign.
Yeah, bad guys getting together and being able to talk using, robust encryption. I guess, you know, my beef with this, and, you know, it's more of a beef with VeriSign than you guys, is that it's sort of the world's worst kept secret that the Global Islamic Media Front was infiltrated several years ago by Saudi intelligence officers.
So what does this mean, do you reckon?
Well, I think perhaps if I was part of a clandestine organisation that had been infiltrated by intelligence agencies, I don't think I'd be using their encryption products with a great degree of confidence.
I think the other point is that the Global Islamic Media Front, if they do have this, and it really did happen, they need to get the kind of media training that Apple uses and not really let this stuff get out.
Well, I figure it this way, mate. If you're trying to be a secret organisation, VeriSign knows what you're up to. You know, I mean, why don't you just pack it in, guys? Raise the white flag. It's over.
Well, do you reckon this is all just there so that you've got these dodgy people who are thinking, oh, we need to speak in encryption. We should get some of that.
Yeah, well, what I don't understand is why anyone thinks that these guys are so dumb that they need the Global Islamic Media Front to tell them what encryption products to use. I mean, if you and me can go and download PGP and use it, why can't they?
Yeah, and we've been able to do for a very, very long time.
Yeah, but apparently this latest encryption tool is called Asra al-Mujahideen, or Mujahideen Secrets. interesting item anyway, but as I said, if I was a jihadi, I'd be staying away from their crypto because there's probably some Saudi agent, using some backdoor is going to get all your info. And, oh, maybe I shouldn't say this.
No, I think you're like, you could be done here for, helping terrorists.
Well,
yeah. Come on, you're helping them out. No, use them, tell them.
Yeah, use them and don't suspect that, yes, all your communications are going straight to the CIA.
Do you have terrorists listening?
I wonder if we do have jihadis listening to, we have excellent intelligence from Risky Business Security Podcast that will help us destroy the infidels.
They told me good stuff.
Yeah, that's it. They told us to stay away from the Global Islamic Media Front.
Oh, God.
Oh, well. Anyway, moving along. Bruce Schneier, everyone's favourite mouthpiece, has been... Well, he is. He's a bit of a mouthpiece, isn't he?
He's definitely an icon, a guru, I've heard him called.
But why do people call Bruce Schneier a guru?
Well, I saw him once on CERT when he came and did the keynote there, and I got to say I was very, very unimpressed with what he was saying there. It was all pretty dull.
I don't know. He's held up as this big icon and this big guru, and I don't really understand why. Anyway, that's rant end of fear.
Anyway, the reason we're ranting on about him is because he did the opening keynote at the Linux conference in Melbourne last week.
Yeah, now you were down there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I actually missed the opening, but I was there for the next couple of days.
Okay, and what did he have to say?
Well, he was just saying that, you know, when it comes to security, people like buying it for because they feel better that they've got the product which is secure. It doesn't mean that they're actually secure. And, you know, it's nothing hugely revolutionary. It's like, yeah, we kind of all knew that. But, yeah, he went there and he said that and apparently went down quite well.
What I find interesting here is that I believe he's in cahoots with BT.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently they bought, is it Counterpain or something?
BT bought Counterpain. And
that was a while back.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, here he is taking big swipes at vendors.
Yeah.
He is a vendor. And he said most security products either address perceived gaps in security and provide an emotional sense of stability without actually doing much useful, or solve actual problems but don't impart the same sense of security.
My favorite quote from him was, when security companies give you cost justifications, they're complete bullshit.
Yeah, unless he's the one giving them.
I guess so.
You know, I mean, I people are always going to, you know, bust out the PowerPoint slides that say how much money this stuff's going to save you, but... So what's he saying? People shouldn't do these projects, or is he saying people should find other justifications? I mean,
I don't think he had a solution. I think he was just pointing out the problem.
Okay, well, useful. Let's move on. Now, this one's a little bit interesting.
Are we talking about the Trend Micro and Clam AV? I really don't understand this. I'm hoping you're going to be able to explain this a bit to me.
Well, Trend Micro is suing Barracuda Networks over its use of the open source antivirus solution Clam AV. Right, so if it wins, you know, all these open source penguin fanciers are jumping up and down and saying, oh, we're all doomed, then it's going to...
Again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's nothing more that open source guys love to say than this threatens the very foundation of our movement, you know.
Yeah.
It's always a movement. It's not like, you know, a bunch of code and repositories maintained by pimply geeks. You know, it's always a movement, like it's going to save the world. But, following months of legal threats issued to Barracuda Networks, Trend Micro is suing its rival over its use of Clam AV. Now, I guess the reason that this story caught my eye is that Clam AV was recently sort of snapped up to be maintained by Sourcefire, which of course is the owner of Snort, and, you know, makes killer industrial grade IDS on the planet. But this is an interesting one, isn't it?
It is. I still don't quite... Whenever people mention patents and suing and that kind of thing, I just tend to turn off and... This, I just really don't understand what's going on. Apparently, Eva Chen, the CEO of Trend Micro, has a patent, which it's got here. The Trend Micro was the first company to extend antivirus protection from the desktop to gateways and servers, and the patent for doing that. So Eva Chen owns a patent that allows you to put an antivirus on your gateway. Is that right? If that's right, then that's just crazy. Who gave her the patent in the first place?
It does, and patents were originally designed to provide temporary protection to an idea to allow you to take it to market. Now, in IT, obviously 10 years is not a very long time, and this patent was granted in 1997. It just seems like patenting the wheel.
And it's ridiculous.
Well, I guess what's interesting here too is they can't go over the open source guys and seek restitution. So they're going after Barracuda for using an open source product in its broader product suite. So...
It's just really, really weird. I hope they just get battered for this because it's just crazy. But, I mean, you know, she owns a patent, so somebody granted her the patent, so it's that person's fault.
Well, apparently the US International Trade Commission ruled against another security company, that being Fortinet, for infringing on the same patent.
Oh, jeez, and that means Trend's probably going to get away with it.
Yeah, so the patent stakes claim to AV software capturing viruses at the gateway through the use of file transfer protocol and simple mail transfer protocol, SMTP. Proxy servers for web and email virus filtering, respectively. So it sounds like one of those really vague, broad patents that someone just thought to get back in the day. But still, I mean, it will be a sad day for security when a patent like that is allowed to stand up, wouldn't you say? You can't hold patent protection on gateway virus scanning. Come on, man.
That is pretty daft. I don't get it. Maybe we should have patented actually using an antivirus product. If you use an antivirus product, we have the patent for that.
Yeah, patent. I've got the patent on using a computer to do stuff.
Yeah.
Man. All right. Now, in other news, Munir, it looks like the Storm botnet, which is, you know, of course, the biggest, baddest botnet ever seen in the history of the universe, has actually been dethroned in terms of badness by another one called Mega D, which apparently is responsible for sending more spam.
Yeah, apparently 32% of all spam being captured by security firm Marshall is sent by this Mega D botnet. So storm only lasted a year, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is one company saying this, which is Marshall. I mean, they might turn out to be correct. They might not. It just might turn out that 32% of all spam captured by them comes from this botnet, but not captured by other companies. We'll have to wait and see. But I think certainly people will be interested in this Mega D malware to see if it is anywhere near as diabolical as Storm was, because Storm was just, you know, as we know, a very tricky bit of malware.
It was, and, you know, it kept developing. So I'm wondering, I mean, according to Marshall here, they're saying that Storm is now reduced to less than 2% of the spam we're tracking at the moment. Now, you know how these things update. These guys have got software updaters much better than any of the other software vendors out there. I'm wondering if they've just updated it and now it's a whole new, much better, bigger botnet.
Well, there was also the rumor that they were going to start selling off little chunks of the Storm botnet because they introduced some sort of peer-to-peer crypto thing which like segmented.
That's right. They were leasing little chunks of it off and then I don't know if you give it back or not, but yeah, that's right. So they were cutting up into smaller pieces to save, well, it helped them basically attack people easier.
So who knows? I mean, they might have broken it up into 100 different botnets and auctioned it off and voila, you know, that would explain it, but
It seems odd to me that, you know, that if what Marshall here is saying is correct, then Storm is now down to just 2% of spam and this thing's 32% of spam. It really seems like it's switched over. I can't imagine that one, you know, there's just a new one that's appeared and the other one's just died. It's the same people behind it, right?
Well, we just got to see. I mean, we do have to see what's happened. And of course, you know, with botnets, you wind up with bot wars, with malware that attacks other malware. And, you know, people try to wrestle control of the command and control channels and stuff like that. So, you know, this is an interesting item because it could be pointing to the death of Storm, but I reckon it's too early to call it.
Yeah, I reckon it's more that Storm has evolved rather than it's died.
Yeah, okay. Well, Manir, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, mate, but thank you very much for joining us again this week.
Hey, no worries, mate. I'll catch you again soon.
It's time now to take a look at an oft-neglected area within security. Now, we all like to think of ourselves in the security industry as being risk managers and people who are intimately tied to business processes. But anyone out there in the field know that that's not usually the case. You've got your tech guys and you've got your auditors and never the twain shall meet. Now, when security professionals are asked to name the world's biggest financial loss due to a data breach or some hackery, they usually mention something like the TJX scandal. Now, that was 45.7 million customer records vamoosed. Now, that includes credit card numbers, thanks to some fairly rudimentary vulnerabilities, some wireless stuff and some SQL stuff. Now, it's hard to put a dollar figure on the data loss in the case of TJX, but it would be safe to say it was in the millions. Well, how about an $8.2 billion loss? That's exactly what was revealed last month when French bank Société Générale came clean over the rogue trading activities of Jérôme Kerviel. The Wall Street Journal reported Kerviel was able to hack into the bank's systems to hide his trades, disable credit and trade size controls, and all of this done to keep compliance and risk management staffers off his scent. Now, these are the guys who are supposed to be cozy with the technology guys. This is what I was getting at. He used other staff members' logins to help obscure his actions, and it's thought the only reason he eventually slipped up and got caught was because he'd broken up with his girlfriend and he'd become a little bit distracted. So from what I've read, it doesn't seem like Kerviel was trying to defraud the company of money for his own gain. He was more of your Nick Leeson type of rogue trader, or those clowns at the currency desk of National Australia Bank a few years ago who lost the bank $360 million or whatever it was. So surely this should be a booming area in information security. There's 8.2 billion reasons to make sure financial systems can detect this sort of stuff, but in this case they didn't. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and we're joined now by our finance sector insider, Adam Poynton, who works as a CSO for a publicly listed global finance company who we won't name. Adam, how much of this absolute clusterfuck disaster is as a result of poor IT and risk controls as opposed to, you know, the actions of someone who knows how to manipulate an administrative system?
I think little, actually. I think the controls and auditing around the whole situation were pretty much sufficient. I mean, a few things could be changed to improve situations, but yeah, I think it was sufficient. It was detected, it was picked up, it was controlled, it was responded to quite quickly. And overall, the fraud was detected and sort of quashed and reduced, at least. The exposure was reduced significantly as well.
Well, he managed to dev-null $8 billion.
Yeah, that actually came down from 50.
So what he'd lost up to 50 and then sort of managed to scurry his way back to 5.
No, I think when they discovered it was actually 50, and they sort of reversed a lot of the things that he'd done, and the exposure in the end was 8 or whatever they're reporting. Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of money. I mean, people point to TJX as being the biggest, technology related incident that's led to real money impact. But here we have a case where a guy is, according to a lot of reports, used his knowledge of IT systems to conceal this fraud. I mean, surely that indicates that the IT systems were, to some degree, inadequate if he was able to get away with this.
Yeah, I think they were inadequate. But the reason why they were inadequate is because he had a sort of fond knowledge of them. I think they're sort of saying that he almost helped design some of the controls and checks and balances. So with somebody with such an intimate knowledge of the control and audit function, bypassing them would be sort of trivial.
Now, this is something that you and I have spoken about prior to this interview, is that you don't believe that someone who has such intimate knowledge of such a critical system should be allowed to actually use that system.
That's right. Well, it's somebody who designs it and builds things like that shouldn't necessarily be operating them, and that's where you have the sort of segregation of duties, and the designer isn't always the user, and that's why you have external auditors and things like that to check the systems and build the control and auditing systems, and they're not actually the users.
Now, while you've said that this wasn't a security problem per se, we've read a number of reports which have suggested that he was actually hacking into servers to remove controls that were designed to detect the very activity that he was engaged in.
Yeah, I think that may have been a little bit of misreporting there, because the actual SOCGEN, they actually released a timeline of events, which was I sort of found interesting from an incident response point of view. They actually said that he did use other people's logon IDs, and that was about the extent that they're sort of advising the hacking was. So, yeah, I mean, he did use other people's logon IDs, their other usernames and passwords, but it's not that he sort of broke into trading servers or anything like that.
So it's not really likely that this guy was using Metasploit and throwing weird malformed IP packets at boxes to pwn them and then, twiddle, in a really sneaky way with software.
No, I think he was in effect twiddling with software, but I think it was all the way he was actually trading and the way he was making, outgoings as well as ingoings and making them balance up. And but he knew how the auditing system worked, and apparently it looked for large cash movements and things like that. Whereas what he did was he sort of flew under the radar of all of those, and he knew what the radars were. So to speak, he could avoid detection.
That's true, but the Wall Street Journal also reported, and this might be a case of misreporting, I mean, it's hard for us sitting on the other side of the planet to know this, but the Wall Street Journal actually said that he had broken into these systems and actually changed the detection thresholds.
I don't know. It did mention that, but if you look at the SOCGEN one, they did say that he used other people's usernames and passwords, and that he actually falsified documents to prove the identity of some of the outgoings. Like, he sort of, if you like, put trades out to some organisation, and then when they queried who the organisation was and whether it actually existed, he presented falsified documentation to say that they were. So, like a fake ACN or ABN, so to speak.
Yeah, well, it's always funny seeing, I mean, you put a document in front of anyone these days in the age of digital fraud, and they're much more likely to believe it because it's actually something physical and tangible.
Exactly, and, that sort of goes back to the sort of social engineering aspect of all of it, the actual physical attack, some nice letterhead and, a suit with your sort of a tradie sort of outfit with your name tattooed on it, the company logo on the hat, and it's believed.
Yeah. Now, Adam, you are the chief security officer of a finance company that we will not name. But if you were the CSO at this organisation, I don't even know how you pronounce it, Société Générale.
Yeah.
If you were the CSO there, I mean, do you reckon you would have been putting in systems and processes in place that might have actually caught this?
I can't sort of speak, I guess, on the knowledge of their systems. I think they by the sounds of things, they had a lot of controls and auditing checks and balances in there. But I probably would have taken a more of approach of attacking the own system and looking at the system from a critical eye, and trying to do transactions like he did and look for flying under the radar and what the radar was to see what could be bypassed.
Well, it almost sounds like a different type of penetration test.
Exactly, yeah. It's more of a risk assessment, I guess, on the processes and you know, the actual auditing and what risks are in the actual audit processes.
Is this a big field? Is this a big field within information security when there's systems involved, or is this something that still belongs in the domains of the auditors, like the Big Four, who, as we know, do such an amazing job?
Yeah, an amazing job. I don't believe the Big Four would detect something like this. It's definitely intimate knowledge of the systems, unless they were very, very intimate with the systems and knew the ins and outs of the control as well as the actual process. Not the process of control, but the processes that are trying to be controlled and audited, they wouldn't detect a gap that he exploited to conduct this fraud.
Well, I'm not trying to be a bastard here, but that to an extent contradicts what you said at the start of the interview, which is that this is, you know, was not really a systems problem.
It wasn't really an IT systems problem. It's more of a problem around the auditing and the analysis and detection of the fraud measures, but also one angle of things that could be used to prevent this is like two-factor authentication on large transactions. But having said that, two-factor authentication on large transactions wasn't really the problem. The problem was multiple smaller transactions that didn't appear as significant cash movements and things like that, which is what they were auditing for.
Okay.
I'm not really sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Sort of death by a thousand paper cuts.
Just more that, I guess, systems were in place to detect and audit and control certain events, but because he had intimate knowledge of those controls and what they were looking for, he was able to put transactions in that sort of sufficed the audit control procedures and checks and balances, but still allowed him to commit fraud.
So it's quite possible that what we're saying here is someone with less knowledge of the auditing systems probably would have been detected and caught much earlier.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it goes back to the whole insider threat scenario.
Absolutely. Definitely because he had intimate knowledge of the checks and balances and auditing around the processes that he was able to slot nice transactions in to avoid them.
So I guess what we're saying here is if someone's designed a security system to be on the lookout for bad behaviour, you don't want to put them in a position where that same system is looking for them doing bad behaviour.
Correct, yeah. It's kind of the segregation of duties thing. If somebody builds the monitoring system, you don't want them to then be the person being monitored.
Yeah.
Because they will know exactly what is being looked at. I guess, incidentally, the thresholds were raised. Like, it did actually trigger an event where other people outside of the sort of trading desk or whatever where he was, on the audit committee, I guess, or whatever, did actually sort of follow that up, and that's what led to the detection of the transaction.
Well, so, there's another thing that led to the detection of the transaction is he started getting sloppy, and all reports say it's because...
Yeah, that's right. He recently broke up with his girlfriend.
I mean, we all get a little bit thrown, but come on, man.
Well, I guess on a, you know, $50 billion, that's
a bad breakup, number, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think increasingly people in positions like yours, you know, there is that real convergence between IT security and the heavy technology stuff and risk. Do you think increasingly that, you know, risk management teams within the finance sector are going to turn to the technology guys and say, hey, how do we find a way to detect this stuff better?
Definitely. There's definitely a convergence there because the technology guys can detect all they want, but if the detection isn't appropriate for the business processes, then you're not going to detect the fraudulent activities such as...
You are not the same guy I went to high school with. Are you hearing yourself? Risk management, processes, what's happened to you? I bet you're wearing an Italian suit right now. This is just...
Yes.
Well, okay, Adam. Well, thank you very much. We'll look for those increased meshing between the IT risk controls and the business processes and making sure they're appropriate.
Excellent.
And we'll have you back on the show again soon, I'm sure. Thanks again for your time.
No problem. Cheers.
Now, as regular listeners know, Risky Business is a sponsored podcast. We are a commercial outfit. In exchange for sponsorship fees, IT Radio allows its sponsors to come onto the show and have a voice on a security-related topic. It helps them get out there and be a part of the debate among our listeners, who are obviously, you know, the smartest people in the industry, and it makes putting this program together possible. We need the money to be able to dedicate the time to do it. And it's also going to allow us to improve the IT Radio site later this year. We'll be introducing heaps of new features and maybe some more audio content. We'll see. So, of course, we love our sponsors, and so should you. Anyway, this week, the show is brought to you by the fine folks at Sophos Security and Control. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're speaking to the company's head of technology in the Asia-Pacific region, Paul Ducklin, about trends in badware. He's got a different take on the increased sophistication of malware than the average person. Ducklin argues that multi-stage malware is actually easier to clean up after than the simple stuff.
Well, I think a lot of people read about modern malware that comes in an email and you click on the link and it takes you to a malicious iframe, and the iframe takes you to an exploit, and the exploit takes you to the malware, and the malware runs on your computer, steals your password, and sends it out. It sounds much more sort of organized, sci-fi, dangerous, and terrible than the old days where the guys just mailed you a virus and said, please kindly run this for me. But the good news for us is that by forcing cyber criminals to take this more staged approach, we actually get multiple sort of stages along the way in which we can actually cut off the threat and break it. So we don't necessarily need to block every stage. If we can deal with any one of them, obviously the earlier the better, then we can actually stop them from achieving their final result.
Can you give us an example of that, of how that might work?
Just looking at our stats for last year, I think the dwarf, aka Storm Worm, appeared in about 10% of emails. In other words, you get an email and the malware is actually inside it. Now, that pretty much gives you two chances to block it. You can block it at your email gateway, and you can block it at your endpoint. So although it seems simpler to do because the thing is more exposed, it's straight in the email, you have only got two chances to block the threat. And it looks as though people are getting smarter about not clicking on attachments. Not everybody, but many people are. So cyber criminals have tried to get more and more devious. So if you think of a malware like the Zlob, Zlob, Trojan, that normally comes in a spam that tries to persuade you to go off to a website to download a codec to watch some video of some sort, and when you download the codec, what you get is the malware. So that now gives you three points at which you can block the thing. You can block it on your PC at the final stage, you can block it at your mail gateway on the way in, but you also get a chance, if you're doing some kind of web filtering, to chop off the malware being downloaded at all. So they're, although they're trying to make the thing seem a little more seditious, they're actually now giving you three bites at the cherry, as it were. The real thing I was hoping to get people aware of is, particularly with the apparently more complicated threat, you know, the email links to iframe, links to JavaScript, links to exploit, etc., that there is one real problem in there, and that is that the original link in the spam that goes off to the iframe that takes you to the rest of the damage is almost always these days an otherwise legit site.
So someone's actually taken it over and put some malware up, you know.
The thing is, they don't need to have sufficient remote control that they can get a full file with malware on there, which might get noticed. All they need to do is to add a single line of ASCII text to any of your HTML pages, just append it, an iframe, and that's, if you like, an invisible auto-clicked link. So you go to what looks like, you know, legitsite.org, and then in the background, you've actually been redirected somewhere else. There certainly was a report of a number of infected sites where, instead of just having some infected or modified HTML pages that link you somewhere else, we saw a load of sites where the actual server, and these servers were, in general, seemed to be running Linux, not Windows, where the servers were actively infected. And what this allowed them to do is, one in every two or three times you visited a page, it would insert a randomly named script that went and fetched some malware off that compromised site. What that means is that the probability that if you're just out looking for bad stuff on the web to try and be a good internet policeman, that you might actually not find the malware the first or the second or even the third time you go there, which means that there's an element of uncertainty and there's an increased element of difficulty in actually mapping where the bad guys are.
Does that make your life difficult?
Well, it makes it more fun.
That's another way of looking at it, I suppose.
One thing, what the good news is, as I intimated earlier, that when you make things more complicated for the bad guys, in other words, that they can't just send you an attachment and an email and think that it will work most of the time, is that the harder you make it for them, the more likely it is that something will go wrong along the way, particularly if there are many stages to the attack, and the more vigorously you're able to clean up if something does go wrong.
Now, what sort of proportion of infections would you estimate are coming from those attacks that come from people actually clicking on a dodgy link?
I can't measure that, unfortunately, because often when people are infected, either they don't report it anymore, they just go, whoops, I've been a dummy, and they go to their antivirus software and clean up, and sort of no harm done. Well, not much harm done. So in many cases, we never get to find out. So in that case, you might not even know that there's been an infection. And it's also quite hard to run backwards. If someone only realizes that it's all gone wrong when they've been infected, the only way we could really trace that back is if they're infected with a piece of malware, which we've only ever seen, or is in a family that we've only ever seen, distributed by one particular mechanism. And apart from the very, very common malware families like Dorf, aka Storm, and Zlob, that's not really the case. So it's actually quite hard to decide what the hole was, or what the protectional gap was, that allowed people to get infected.
You say that attachments these days aren't much of a threat, and you really don't see much of that sort of trouble as you used to. I'd imagine you're saying that links in emails are the equivalent to what attachments were a few years ago. What's next after that? After we've really sort of trained people and put the software everywhere that can deal with it.
Well, one of the problems with saying, oh, once we fix the web link clicking problem, and remember with iframes, you don't actually click the link. The link's sort of implicitly clicked in the HTML for you, which is a bit of a problem.
Well, depending on which mail client you use, yeah.
Indeed. I think one of the problems is, as you mentioned, although attachments are not such of a gain for the bad guys anymore, and they're down from about 25 in 1,000 emails 2 years ago, to 3 in 1,000 emails 1 year ago, to about 1 in 1,000 now have attachments in. That's still quite a lot when you think of how mail volume has grown over the last 1 or 2 years. And what that means is that we never quite get rid of the malware of the past.
Mm.
One thing that makes me say that is it was sometime last year, if I remember correctly, that a supermarket chain in Germany that sells PCs managed to sell Windows Vista computers with a variant of the stoned virus pre-installed in the master boot sector, if you don't mind.
Nice.
So here's a virus that came out in 1990, perhaps, and hasn't been seen in the wild for 10 years, suddenly reappears fresh on everybody's hard disks.
Mm.
The problem is that we never quite get rid of the threats of the past, unless they happen to depend on a technology which we completely leave behind, such as floppy disks. You don't normally get that kind of virus anymore. And
unless you're talking about picture frames from Best Buy.
Well, I guess that's the modern equivalent of a floppy disk, isn't it? Except that they've got, 7,000 times the capacity or whatever.
Yeah, so I guess we're just putting more and more malware on the junk heap that's not really decomposing, as it were.
Well, that's one of the reasons why it's very rare for us or any antivirus vendor to retire detection of old malware. Everyone says, oh, why don't you just throw out all the old stuff? Because it'll save huge amounts of memory and huge amounts of time in scanning. Well, in fact, if you look at the rate at which new malware appears, even if we throw out everything up to, say, 1995, that's only a small fraction of the amount of data that we need to detect everything. So it really wouldn't make that much difference. And we never know when one of these sort of old favorites is going to suddenly make a comeback, like a Word macro virus or an Excel formula virus, or, as in the case of the supermarket chain I nearly accidentally mentioned the name of, Stone.Angelina.
Okay, well, Paul, thank you very much for your insights this week, and I'm sure we'll be speaking again next month.
Paul, thanks for talking to me, Patrick.
And that wraps it up for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you'll check back in for another episode soon. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. And taking out the show this week is a track from a very groovy Australian band named Afro Dizzy Act, and the song's called The Pilgrim. Now, you can buy this track from soundfoundation.com.au. Enjoy.